This is Phil Farron.
And I am driving home. It's Thursday day. It is episode 539, I think. I've got 538 written on my little pieces of paper here, but that's not right. I think it's 539. On our way to 2000. All is well. Things have gone just fine this week. We got a lot of good things done. Move forward to the next step. Yada, yada, yada. All that kind of good stuff. So that's good. The client I work for is ramping up and for one of their big biennial conferences, and then their particular department that I'm working with is having a first of its kind major conference after that, so things are going to get really quiet over the next couple of weeks, but that's okay. There's things to do and people to see and jobs to be done and et cetera, et cetera. So it will be just fine. All is well with the writing. I'm right at the end of chapter 24. These books are supposed to go to about 31 chapters in there. I think I'm on target for that. Seems like I am. We'll find out. You never know. You just never know till you get right up against it. And then it's like, nope, there's another chapter. And I've had plenty of times when it's felt like, nope, there's another chapter. And then you get that one as, nope, there's another chapter. So we'll see. I've got a good epilogue this time. At least I think I have a good epilogue, which is where we're supposed to have a little bit of a tearjerker. I think it'll be fine. It'll be fun. I don't have all the pieces of it, but I can feel it. I can feel it sitting out there. And I've got, you know, some images of my mind, and then I just have to flesh it out. So, this is book 11, of course. And book 10, I really enjoyed writing the epilogue in book 10. It was fun. It just was fun. I knew, about halfway through the book, I knew where it was going to be, and it was fun. It worked out like I wanted it to, and people seemed to enjoy it, so yay. Anyways, so yeah. Coming up here soon, hopefully in about 2 or 3 weeks, maybe, I will have book 11 roughed in, and then I'll be spending the next month getting the read-through done and basic editing, getting a cover built. I've already got some ideas for the cover, so it'll be fun. And then once I get that shipped out to the beta readers, then we start book 12. Hopefully we start book 12 somewhere around the third, fourth week of September, and then try to get half of book 12 done before the beta copies come back in. Book 12. 12! That's halfway. Fun stuff. It's really, really fun stuff. What else happened this last week? Over the weekend, we took a quick trip up to St. Louis to see two sets of friends. So that was lovely. I had some friends from California come in. And they actually came into Chicago for a wedding, rented a car, came down to St. Louis to go to City Museum, and then had contacted us and said, hey, we're going to be in St. Louis. Is there any way we can have breakfast? And we said, yes, because I had been wanting to go up to St. Louis anyways, because my friends have another set of friends up there that I probably have mentioned at this point. that had babies, twin girl babies, at the end of April. And they were only to 22 weeks. They had preemie twin girls at 22 weeks, which is just right on the edge. So, hadn't been up to seeing them, was really feeling like I needed to get up, and this kind of gave us the impetus to do it. And it was good to see our friends. It was good to see our friends. And we got a chance to go see those babies. So, we just keep praying. Just keep praying. Life and health and prosperity to those babies. Everly and Riley are their names. And it was a good visit. It was God's time, God's place. It was a good visit. And it's just amazing that our friends are doing as well as they are, apparently, with preemies like this, this early. There's just so many things that can go wrong that even now, even when they are close to their due date, which would have been, I think, first week of August, even now, high percentage, 90%, more than that, if I remember correctly, that the babies aren't going to survive. And even if they do survive to where they can take them home, high percentage that they will have some major health difficulty simply because of the development. So, you know, that's difficult. And our friends have been in that grinder. They've been in that grinder since end of April. So we just keep praying for them. We just keep praying for the babies. We just keep praying. And we'll see. We'll see. So, it was a good weekend. It was a good week, good weekend. Looking forward to another good weekend coming up. International Cat Day is coming up. It's not tomorrow, but 2 weeks. 2 weeks, August the 9th, which happens to be my daughter's birthday. It will be my daughter's, she was born in 82, she was born in 82, so this would be her 37th? No, 82, 37th, are you kidding me? No, that can't be, maybe it is, goodness, I'm going to have to ask her when I get home. Is this really going to be your 37th birthday? Goodness. August the 9th. And goodness. Wow. I just rocked myself back. Anyways. Goodness. That's amazing. Anyways, I actually had some notes prepared for last week, and then of course last week I just kind of talked my way through the parable for book 11, the parables really for book 11, and it's interesting, it's so interesting on these books because it seems like whatever parable I'm on, all of a sudden there are these life applications in my life at the time I'm going through that parable. And man, when you start talking about the tension between expectations and the unexpected, my buddy and I, he had lived out at the Rock House, and so, you know, for years, every 2 weeks or so, we had gone for walks and got up there on Thursday night. We had our breakfast with our friends from California on Friday, took our friends with the Preemie twins to lunch on Friday. Annette and I went to IKEA. She wanted to shop there, and we kicked around on Friday. And then Saturday morning, I got up, met my buddy at like 7 o'clock in the morning. We went for a walk. It's good to see him again. And, you know, at one point we started talking about expectations and the unexpected. And I told him, I said, I don't know that I've got this all worked out, but I'll just tell you what I've got. And he was good. It's God's place, God's time. I think my wife and I are going to try to find some extra time, maybe every couple of months, to get up there just to see him. Just to do what we can. Anyway, so I had some notes for last week. I wasn't really completely happy with the thing, but I thought, oh, well, this is good enough. It's interesting. Then I came across another article that I just thought, wow, that's an interesting way of putting this. And I thought, you know, maybe we'll do this one instead and we'll get back to those other notes at some point. But I came across an article. And the title of the article was Modern Media is a DOS Attack on Your Free Will. In other words, modern media is a denial of service attack on your free will. Just for those of you who aren't familiar with denial of service attacks, these happened on the internet. The interesting thing about the internet is it wasn't really built for what it's being used for. When it started out, it was just kind of a basic network to, if I recall correctly, just exchange information between some government entities and like universities. It was just kind of a little experiment. So there were certain things about the experiment that maybe if it was the internet was redesigned today, it would be done differently. And one of those things is that it's the internet is an open platform. I mean, it's like anybody can send communication requests to anybody else. So you have a website out there and it's on the internet, and people look up your domain name server entry and they get an IP address and they can just send requests to you for information. And they can send as many requests as they want to you for information. And this is what a denial of service attack is. That hackers they compromise a bunch of computers using phishing tools. Take control of all these computers, and then they push a button and they just flood a service with requests for information. And the server just can't keep up with all the requests for information because they just come in the thousands and thousands and thousands. And the computer locks up, the server locks up. And there are various ways to try to help that, as far as routing and those kinds of things. But if the internet was going to be built today, and if everyone had to register, and if in order to communicate with a server you had to be approved on that server, and you know, there were a few more practical security items in place, it would be much, much harder to do a denial of service attack. Whether or not you could shut them off altogether, that would be an interesting design problem, but we don't have that. So in terms of a denial of service attack, then really what that is flooding the capacity of the receiver and overloading at it. So the article is titled "Modern Media is a Denial of Service Attack on Your Free Will," which is an interesting idea. And the article is about James Williams, who is a doctoral candidate at Oxford's Internet Institute's Digital Ethics Lab, whose motto is, quote, "every bit as good," unquote. Which is, that's cute. That's very cute. That every bit would be good that travels over the internet, which is an admirable motto, but I don't think it's going to happen, since in the history of technology, one of the sure guarantees that a technology will be successful is if it includes some new way to spread pornography. And you can look back through the history and prove that. So I doubt every bit as good is actually going to come about, but at least it is a very noble motto. And it talks about James Williams, who was involved early on in Google's advertising efforts. It says that he had a "God, what have I done" moment during his time at Google. It's not that he had that, but it did occur to him that something had gone awry. So he was there when they opened their doors in 2006, the Seattle office. He went on to win the company's highest honor, which is the Founders Award for developing advertising products and tools. He said then, 6 years later, in 2012, he realized that these tools were actually making things harder for him. "Modern technology platforms," he explained to me, "were reimposing these pre-internet notions of advertising, where it's all about getting as much of people's time and attention as you can." I found that funny. This was in 2012, where he was thinking that this idea of advertising pre-internet was about getting as much of people's attention and time as you could. Because if we would use that phrase now, yeah, so these things are trying to get as much of your time and attention as possible, our immediate conclusion would be, oh, you're talking about the internet. So this isn't really something new. I mean, this was happening before the internet. It'll be happening on whatever the successor is to the internet. Because as long as there's money to be made and businesses involved, this is what they're going to do. One moment, I'm getting my mail. But I thought the guy did have some very interesting points. One moment, let me just check down below. Because he was saying that, so in 2012, he realizes, wait, something's going awry. And in 2011, he had already moved to London because he was interested in attending Oxford and pursuing a degree. It said, so in he's there, he's seen what's going on. In 2014, then, he co-founded a movement called Time Well Spent. That's a movement to stop technology platforms from hijacking our minds. Good luck with that. But, hey, it's a noble sentiment, and I hope he's successful. I just don't think he's going to be. But, you know, let's say that things will be great, and he will. Even though the world, and the devil are going to guarantee that this isn't going to happen. But he stopped this movement called Time Well Spent, and they partnered with Moment, an app that tracks how much time you spend in other apps. Time Well Spent asked 200,000 people to rate the apps they used most after seeing the screen time it demanded of them. They found that on average, the more time people spent in an app, the less happy they were with it. Distraction wasn't just this minor annoyance, he said. There was something deeper going on. That's why I came over here to start my PhD on that stuff. So he recently wrote an essay called Stand Out of Our Light, Freedom and Persuasion in the Attention Economy. It won him like a $100,000 Nine Dots Prize and scored him a book deal with Cambridge Press University. So obviously, smart guy, good writer, and he's striking on a nerve. But the author of the article asked him, so how do the internet and social media apps threaten democracy? And he said that democracy assumes a set of capabilities, the capability for deliberation, understanding different ideas, reasoned discourse. This grounds governmental authority, the will of the people. So one way to talk about the effects of these technologies is that they are a kind of denial of service attack on the human will. Our phones are the operating systems for our lives. They keep us looking and clicking. I think this wears down certain capacities like willpower by having us make more decisions. A study showed that repeated distractions lower people's effective IQ by up to 10 points. It was over twice the IQ drop that you get from long-term marijuana usage. Said there are certainly epistemic issues as well. Fake news is a part of this. Epistemology is the study of truth, by the way. So there's certainly truth issues as well. I think that's right. I need to look it up, but I think that's right. Fake news is a part of this, but it's more about people having a totally different sense of reality, even within the same society or on the same street. It really makes it hard to achieve the common sense of what's at stake, and that is necessary for an effective democracy. And he talked about the fact that, things have changed in terms of the roles of newspapers and the roles of news gathering. And we've talked about this before. He said, if the business, the role of the newspaper is to filter, and you pay attention to the things that matter. He said, but if the business model is like advertising, and you get a good article in, and a good article is an article that gets the most clicks, you get things like clickbait, because those are the only matrices. How many clicks do you get? Just say whatever. There was a funny, what was it today? There was a, oh, I think it was maybe New York Times, it was some big like thing like, you know, and the article was something along the lines of Democrats hoped for electrifying interview with Mueller, but it short-circuited impeachment or something like that. And it was like, wow, you guys worked a long time on that headline to try to get some people to click on this thing. And the article talks about, this man talks about the fact that advertising has dragged everyone down, even the wealthiest organizations with noble missions to compete on terms of clickbait. Every week there are these outrage cascades online. Outrage is a rewarding thing to us because it fulfills a lot of psychological needs we have. It could be used to help us forward, but often they're used to keep us clicking and scrolling and typing. Then he was also asked about Tristan Harris, with whom he co-founded Time Well Spent. Tristan Harris said that tech steers the thoughts of 2 billion people with more influence than the world's religions or governments. Would you agree? And he says he does. And you know what? He said, I certainly think it intervenes at a lower level, closer to people's attention than governmental or religious systems. I think it's closer to being like a chemical with a drug or some sort than it is to being a societal system. He said Snapchat has this thing called Snapstreak, for example, where it says, here's how many days in a row you've taken a snapshot photo with someone. You brag to your friends how long you've done it. There's a ton of these kinds of methods and non-rational biases. Social comparison is a huge one. So there's a guy who wrote a book called Hooked, where he teaches designers how to pull a user into a system. So, I mean, it's interesting because we're seeing this more and more where people are just glued to their phones. And I think he's right that you spend all of that time with a device that keeps saying, look at me, 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 and that's pinging your dopamine system when you're on Twitter and when you're on Facebook and when you're on Instagram and you're looking at new stuff and you're getting likes and, you know, yada, yada, yada. And the problem is he talks about the evolving forms of technology and how that there has always been an attraction and fascination with new technology when it came on, and that has joined forces. So like radio was just coming on in the run-up to World War II, and there was a fascination with it, so people wanted to listen to it because it was something new. And Hitler wanted everybody to have a radio in Germany because then he hit that interest in that. What are we going to listen to? Well, we'll listen to Hitler. And Hitler used that medium of radio then to spread his rise. And he does, James William, he does point out statistics I've heard before that are really good statistics. He said, if you think about how long we had to come to terms with the dynamics of radio, the telephone, etc., it's almost one or two generations. So there would be this new advance, and then we would have a couple of generations to come to terms with it. He said, as electric media has advanced more and more, the time to reach 150 million users accelerates. He said, I think radio was something like 60 or maybe 70 years. Television was something like 30 or 40 years. Today, for technology like an app to reach 150 million users, it could be a matter of days. He said, I think what happens is that we never actually get to the place of stability and mastery of the technology. We're always in this learning curve of incompetence. We can use it well enough, but not so well that we can master it before the next thing comes along. So there's just this onslaught constantly for our attention. Where will you place your attention? Where will you place your attention? And when there's that onslaught, then you just run out of mental energy to make good decisions. The interviewer said, isn't our own fault that we're too easily distracted? Maybe we just need more self-discipline. And he said, that kind of rhetoric implicitly grants the idea that it's okay for technology to be adversarial against us. The whole point of technology is to help us do what we want to do better. Why else would we have it? I think part of the open door that these industries have walked through is the fact that when we adopt a new technology, we don't typically ask, what is it for? If we were to ask what a smartphone is for, it would be almost a ridiculous question. It's for whatever it can do now. So, you know, this is interesting to me, and it's true that we are living in this incredible age. He was asked, do you think information technology is on our side? And he said, to the extent that the goal of the design is just to capture and keep our attention, it's predominantly not on our side. If it's not even equipped to know what our goals are a lot of the time, I don't see how it can be. I think that kind of information exchange would be necessary for it to move in the right direction. One standard I use is GPS. If GPS distracted us in physical space in the ways that other technologies distract us in informational space, no one would keep using that GPS. That's an interesting observation. So, of course, they ask about, well, what can, you know, how long will it take? What do we think that this is going to do? And he's got a lot of ideas. I'll let you read the article if you want. And he's asked, you know, are you optimistic? And he said, in terms of individuals working at these companies, I'm still heartened and optimistic because everybody who's a designer or engineer is also a user at the end of the day. No one goes into design because they want to make life worse. The challenges generally are structural, whether it's about the existing business models of companies or the way in which certain forms of legal corporate structures don't give people the space to balance some of the more petty, immediate goals with more noble kinds of things. It's hard to say, in terms of the longer-term tech evolution, whether it will be optimistic or not. I'm hoping that there will be a point where, if we don't restrain things or turn the battleship around, we realize the unsustainability of it from a business point of view, not only from a business point of view, but also from our lives. Yeah, you know, I'm back to the same thing that I've always kind of been back with as far as the future goes. You know, we are very clever. We are very clever because we're made in the image of God, but we are also disasters because of the flesh. And if we had supposedly noble institutions like the major news outlets who have stumbled seemingly to me so badly in the last 20 years, who have come to the point where they just get so mad when people calls them fake news, and yet you read opinion pieces and you read headlines from these major news organizations, and it's obvious that it's all just clickbait. They're just desperate to get you to click on that link. And it all comes back to that whole idea that windfall is all about. It doesn't matter what all your principles are. It doesn't matter what you say you are for. It doesn't matter that Google's motto is don't be evil. In my mind, at least, the fact is that any entity that becomes aware of its own existence has a first principle that eclipses everything else. How do I continue to exist? And I don't know of any business that's going to walk away from that. And because of that, I don't know how this could get better. Except it can get better for the individual, because you can put the phone down. You can turn the phone off. You can take time. Here recently, I may have mentioned this, I'm taking time. You know, when I go for the walk in the morning, I just breathe. And I just look at everything I'm seeing in that moment. I just focus my attention on that because it's such a privilege to be able to safely go for a walk. It's such a privilege to live out in the country in the beautiful, crisp morning, and to be able to walk along and look at the flowers and listen to the birds. Such a privilege that I take advantage of that. And while I don't know that there's any solution for the corporate side of all of this, I think there is a solution for each of us. Because I think it's a really good concept to make sure that you are making yourself aware that your attention is not infinite. And just allowing anything to steal more and more of that attention is not good. That you get to be the steward of what takes your attention. And really, you know, the Bible says, as a man thinks in his heart, so is he. And I think that puts an amazing responsibility on us for how we decide where we're going to focus our attention, how we decide what is worthy of our attention. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.